It's our annual Insight Summit, and this year we're looking at an issue that some of you may be deep into what it is, and some of you may have no idea at all. It is one of those issues, by the end of today's session, you will know a lot more about it and how it impacts on the CEE and SEE markets, and it does. I won't hold things up because we are running a little bit behind, so I just want to say thank you very much to our panel for joining us today. We have Cade, Pavel, Ian, Robert, Otis, Dieter, and Hadley. All very well-known figures, very successful figures in the market to have a good handle on this. And we also have, we worked very closely with the JLL Capital Markets team on this issue, and we are very pleased to have a keynote presentation by them to kick things off. So I'd like to welcome now to the stage Matthew Richards and Robert Stassen of JLL Capital Markets team, European Capital Markets team.
We're going to talk about the wall of capital, how it affects real estate markets, and we have asked ourselves basically three questions. Why do we see all this capital coming into real estate? Who are they? Who are behind all that capital? And then finally, what is the impact on your market, on the CEE in particular? The why bit will be me. The who bit will be Matt. And together we'll do the implications on the what bit. So it'll be Matt and me. So to start with the why question, what we believe at JLL is that we are in a structurally changing real estate market. And there's four reasons for it. We think the cause of all this, we're in an era globally of global savings, not only in the developed markets, but also increasingly in the developing markets, the emerging markets. We've seen enormous Chinese life insurers coming to Europe. And there's a lot of capital there, which is now starting to be used to fund future pension liabilities, future social welfare liabilities further down the road. We've seen the same thing also in the developed world. People are reading those little pages saying, well, when you retire in 15 years from now, this is what you get. It's not enough. So people are putting more money in their pension funds, more money with insurers. So what can you go back? We have to improvise a little bit here. So that is the cause of all this capital coming this way. But if all this capital is going to come this way, can they buy enough real estate? Is there enough real estate? Well, to actually make that happen, we think you need a catalyst. And my background is in equities, and always when you tell a story, this is undervalued, how will it go to fair value? There needs to be a catalyst. What we believe is that big data will be that catalyst, because big data will make markets more transparent. And then we call it Phoenix Capital, which is not a funny hedge fund name. It's actually the consequence of what happens. What we believe is that transparency will make new real estate available for investing. And then what is also important to realize is the method in how this wall of money invests. It's different from the traditional way of investing in real estate. So this is what we're going to talk about. And on the next slide, just to give you a bit of indication about how big this pool of money is. We've looked at some of the big pension funds in the world. And what we've done is we said, well, the most developed real estate investors probably are the European pension funds. And if you look at their allocation to real estate, it's about 11%. And some of them actually want to move that further. If you look at CPPIB, they would like to go to 14%. But if you look at all the others, they're seriously under-allocated to real estate. So what we are seeing now is particularly forced by all these, I would say, low-interest environments. People are looking for these illiquid asset classes where you can get that premium. And they call it alternative assets. And within alternative assets, real estate is the most important. And what they say when you talk to all these advisors to pension funds, they say 60-40 is debt, 40-40-20 is the new thing. You need to get 20% in alternative assets. But if you look at the Japanese government pension fund, the biggest one in the world, they have zero allocation to that. So they are starting to slowly, because they're pension funds, slowly build up that, that exposure. What will be the catalyst? We think technology is there, and we're doing a lot of data mining within JLL. We're not the only ones. There will be much more data available going forward because the technology is there. Google and all the algorithms will change our industry forever. Also, this new money is different in a way that they're not investing their own money. They're investing money of pensioners. So they have a lot of fiduciary duties to their boards to report what they're doing. And then look at the regulators. The Bank of England was surprised. They didn't know exactly how much money was lent against commercial property. They had an idea about residential, but not so much about commercial. So now they're starting to force the sector to open up. give us more data so that we can manage and control the industry much better than before. And that all leads to a lot of commercial activities, which makes it, I would say, a very good investment to start delivering all this data to our industry. And what it just means is when markets get more transparent, they get more liquid. And at JLL, we've done a lot of work on transparency with our Global Transparency Index. We've done it since 1999. And what we do see is the more transparent a market is, the more liquid it is. And you can see that here on the left of the chart. Then the final, one of the final issues is where can all this new money find the new real estate? Well, if you just look back here, this is for the last 4 years, and almost half of every real estate investment has been done in these 30 cities. In a way, it's the Dow 30, so to speak. And we all know that the Dow 30 changes over years, so Apple is going to come in. So this might change as well. But besides the Dow 30, the Dow Jones, there's also the S&P 500, there's the Russell 2000. There's much more than that. So what we expect will happen is that people will just move out. They will move out to different markets. And that is already happening. And we think it will continue to happen. And that will make these markets bigger. They move from small caps to mid caps and from mid caps to large caps. But also they will move out, I would say, the comfort zone of traditional real estate investing. They would look at new sectors, nursing homes, caring homes, healthcare, residential in certain markets. And also they will try to find another way of getting exposure to real estate risk, because that is basically what they're investing in. And they want to have a risk-adjusted return to that essential real estate risk, because that lowers their portfolio total risk. So the way of understanding the method and the thinking is just to give you an example of why we're seeing all this and how they do things differently. This really shook up America. Detroit went bankrupt. And why did it go bankrupt? Because 60% of all their debt was related to pension liabilities and post-retirement benefits. So it means that there is a big problem in the US in the pension fund sector. And they're seriously underfunded. And what they can do in the US, but they can't do in Europe, they can discount their liabilities at historic returns. So they discount their liabilities at 7%, so they need a 7% portfolio return. If you have 40% still in fixed income in the US, that means that the other 60% probably has to do double-digit returns. So what are they doing? They're putting their money into real estate, expecting at least double-digit returns. And who do they give it? Well, they give it to the big names, the private equity funds. So that's why we've seen so much of the private equity funds going into real estate, investing the money of these pension funds. And this is what they have been doing in Europe. And you can see now that they've never been as active as ever before. Their market share is 12% last year. It was never, ever over 4%. So that's what they've done in Europe. But to get a better idea of what they're doing in CE, I'll hand over to Matt.
Thank you, Robert. So that was the brains of the operation. I'm afraid I'm the surveyor, and we'll try and bring it a bit down to the level. So what have we seen? Robert's touched upon it. Last year, we had more international investors into Europe than we've ever seen before. It reached a level of 40% of all purchases across Europe were by international investors. When we look at CEE, many commentators would say, well, surely it can't be that high. Well, actually, when you look at CEE, you're looking at that, and again, you're hitting about 40% of the market was done and transacted by non-European investors. The bar charts here pick up a number of different colours. I won't spend too long on them, but I'm going to focus on a couple of different parts. So the first part is the bracket which I call global stroke USA. Why do I call it global stroke USA? Many commentators have split those two categories out. One of the reasons why I don't is because I look at it and I say, if you look at the global funds, which are typically the private equity funds, which Robert has just talked about, their capital is driven by the American LPs, for some of the reasons which Robert has just touched upon. And those American LPs are becoming increasingly important to whether it's a Blackstone, whether it's a Tristan, whether it's a Starwood. All those guys, a lot of that money comes from the different endowment and the pension funds. What are they looking for? They're looking for 11% plus returns. A lot of that is to offset the risk of going overseas. They were at the vanguard of investing into Europe. They are now getting pushed out of the core markets, and they have to go and look at new markets to hit those type of returns. And where are they looking? They're moving to Southern Europe and CEE, where they can hit those, what we would call, outsized returns. But it's not just about the American equity. And many would say, that's nothing new. We've seen them before. Yes, the quantum is different for what Robert's just touched upon, but we have seen them before. So two groups I would like to touch upon where we haven't really seen that much activity yet, but one of our thoughts looking forward is you will, is Chinese and Korean capital. So I've just picked on two for a moment, flavour of the month, should we say. So if we look at Chinese capital, last year Chinese capital invested $16.5 billion into real estate. That was a 48% increase from 2013. Yes, that's on a global basis, but that's a staggering increase. But perhaps more interestingly, that was the first time they invested more outside of China than they did inside China in commercial real estate. And we're seeing a massive growth from Chinese activity, and we expect that to increase. It's impossible to classify and make generalizations about Chinese capital because you have private investors, you have developers, you have the institutions, and you have the sovereign wealth funds. And they all, just like you would do if they were a European investor, act in different ways. However, at this point in time, and Robert will come on to it in a moment, one of the key things is they want a partner. They need the expertise. An example of that, even though our chart doesn't record Asian activity, Asians have already invested in Central and Eastern Europe. They've partnered with groups. The Silesia shopping centre transaction with Poland, that was an Asian investor partnering with Allianz and ECE to get best-in-class partner experience. So then let's move on to the Korean capital. The Korean capital. For the last 2 years, Robert and I have been going to Germany. We've been saying the Korean investors are going to come, the Korean investors are going to come. German institutions said they're not coming, they're not coming, they're not coming. This year, okay, they've done two or three transactions. Maybe it's not the wave that we talk about. But if we look at JLL sales, every office sale over 100 million, 60% of the underbidders were international. And the majority of those were Korean capital. Why are they coming? It's a relatively straightforward model. They want 6% cash-on-cash returns. Borrowing rates are very low. They can get those type of returns from Germany. Increasingly, we expect them to look outside of Germany and move to some of the core markets, such as Warsaw. And they are helped by the fact that their parents, if you call it that, MPS, have already invested doing the Brno deal a few years ago. So they have the traction to be able to go and do those type of investments. And here, just a couple of slides, don't want to hang on it, but this is really showing that growth of Chinese capital outbound and the steady, I would say now, of Korean investments into the marketplace. Now, it would be remiss of me if I finally don't finish without touching upon German investors. On the very first slide, when I showed who were the biggest investors within CE, the biggest investors are European investors. And at the front of that are German investors. For the past 10 years, German investors have invested more internationally than ever in any other country. They've done 150 billion over the last 10 years. Now, we expect that their outbound desire is going to grow. Now, part of that is because, as Robert will touch upon and has mentioned, the massive inflows of capital that a number of their funds are receiving at the moment. But the other part, which is equally as important, is they are facing increased competition in their own domestic market. And that increased competition, again, will force them to look overseas. Robert.
And thank you, Matt. And this is a buzzword you have to remember, smart beta. Because basically smart means cheap for pension funds, but that's what they're being told. They say you have to get your beta, your exposure, but you have to do it in a smart way. You don't necessarily have to do it in the traditional way. And actually this is when you talk to them and say, well, yeah, we want to increase our allocation to real estate. We might buy something direct, but probably we want to do it together with a partner. We could JV, we could club deals, we can do anything you want. Or we could actually go list it, or we can do put money in a fund, but then we don't want to have a discretionary fund, we have more say about it. And this is what they're saying every time we meet them. That means that they will be doing things differently. And that is something to bear in mind, particularly for the CE, because not many of these pension funds know the CE. So they need a partner. And we called it equity and expertise. And we think that will be very, very important in the CE going forward. Matt.
I'm conscious you guys want to hear from the experts, not a couple of agents on the stage. So I'll hand over to Kate in a moment. But just to give some sort of thoughts for the conversation going forward, you know, what do we expect to see? A summary of our thoughts and what's going to happen is we do think you're going to see more international capital come into the CE markets, which is going to increase competition, and will probably drive down the cap rates. But we think a lot of that capital as it enters is going to look for the partnering, to partner with expertise, which may begin to mean there's going to be change in some of that fund management model, where fund managers who are traditionally managing their own capital start to look to managing other capital, as we've seen across the rest of Europe. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Kate to take over from here. Kate.
OK, thank you very much, JLL, for that interesting presentation. Sets the scene very well. My name is Kate Allen. I'm the Financial Times property correspondent. And I, like you, are going to be learning about Central and Eastern European real estate this morning, and afternoon, in fact. I'm going to ask by inviting our panel to introduce themselves, using the microphones on the table, please. Maybe starting from Hadley at the far left and coming in this direction, please.
Hi. Hadley Dean, managing partner for Colliers in Eastern Europe.
Dietrich Nittel, I'm working for Deutsche Pfandbrief Bank, being active in Central Eastern Europe, which is mainly Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and also Hungary, Budapest. And we have done around about 800 million last year in financings in CE.
Hi, my name is Otis Spencer. I'm with Peakside Capital, responsible for activities in Central Eastern Europe, which is mainly comprises investments in Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary. And we cover the spectrum from core investments all the way through opportunistic.
Hello, my name is Robert Martin from Europa Capital. I'm one of the principals and co-founders of the business, and I'm head of Central Europe, and I've been working in the region now for 17 years.
Ian Warboys, CEO of P3 Logistic Parks. We're actually owners and asset managers and developers of about 2.8 million square meters of warehouses across right across Europe in 8 countries, and particularly in Central Europe.
Paweł Dębowski, head of real estate services of Dentons for Europe. I've been in the market for 25 years. I specialize mostly in investment transactions across the region.
Great. To get started, we've seen from JLL this evidence of this huge wall of capital coming into real estate. What's driving this, particularly European real estate? Do any of the investors on the panel wish to comment on what's the rationale behind wanting to get into real estate in this way? Otis, would you like to start?
Sure.
I'll do my best. So what's the question specifically was, what's driving this capital to come into CE? The relative.
Well, first of all, into real estate in the broader sense. Why real estate as opposed to
Whether you're talking to U.S. investors or European investors, I think what JLL touched on is this increased allocation, this concept of getting away from fixed income and equities and rebalancing to have this 20% to alternative asset classes, which is hedge funds, commodities, private equity, and real estate. And so the investors that we're speaking to, all of them are talking about increasing their allocation, whereas a few years ago, real estate was not the flavor of the month. Seems right now it's higher up on the radar screen.
And then bringing it down from the global perspective to the regional perspective, does anybody want to comment on why Europe? What is it about Europe in particular which is attracting people?
Well, I think the interest rates are low. So you've got a low interest rate environment. You've got, at the moment, you've got a very cheap euro. So people are coming for that basis. We've got some quite good fundamentals in Europe at the moment. There's QE happening at the moment, which is hopefully going to drive GDP across Europe better. That can all go against the huge macro risks, the geopolitical risks that we're seeing at the moment, but that's we can talk about that later.
Well, that was going to be my next question, in fact, is that certainly in some European markets, pricing seems to be getting a little enthusiastic, perhaps, running away from the macro picture, and we're not necessarily seeing the macro performance picking up and starting to drive that rental growth to justify. Is it all getting a little optimistic, do we think? Anyone?
Mr. Optimism. if you want an optimistic comment.
Well,
I think Robert touched on the key point in terms of the occupier market. You know, quantitative easing will hopefully drive the occupational market, which has really been lagging behind the wall of capital that we've seen come into the region. So what we have to look at in, let's say, Eastern Europe is what's going to drive that. And I think we're very fortunate that, you know, year on year we have sort of 12% compound growth in the BPO market, which is driving a huge amount of occupational needs, developments, and financing, and ultimately sale. And that is going to continue. ABSL, which is the main, lobbying group that coordinates the BPO industry in Eastern Europe now is the biggest single employer in Poland. So it's something that cannot be ignored. It is here. It's a great opportunity for everyone. But the traditional markets were, led by Germany. Quantitative easing now is really where we're hoping across Western Europe it will catch up.
One of the things that came out from JLL's presentation is that a large proportion of the investors we're seeing in the market are international capital. They may not be very experienced in the market. As you say, they're looking for partners to work with in an attempt to mitigate some of the risk that any new entrant to a market faces, and particularly in real estate, arguably. But even so, is this level of relatively inexperienced newbie investor interest, is it good news or is it an alarm bell?
I think for us it was very good news, as we had TPG and Ivanhoe Cambridge bought us from our capital about 15 months ago. And of then, and the reason they bought us was the expertise that we have in warehouses across Europe. And that expertise, if you look at the companies just in our market, there aren't many people who have it, and there certainly aren't many who were available to buy. So I think that the investors really are looking for management teams in core industries that have the knowledge to be able to grow. And they have to have faith in that management team to put their investors' money into it and to see the returns. And that has to be a specialist thing.
And I'm not sure I would call them inexperienced in a broad sense. I probably would call them inexperienced in those particular markets, but not necessarily inexperienced investors, especially, I would say, Chinese or Middle East money.
And especially you see this on the logistics market, yeah? I mean, you're one example, but, for example, the same happened with Prologis, for example, or Segro. Yeah, because I think also it comes to lot sizes. Yeah, because I mean all these investors, they are really targeting big lot sizes, and of course that is also one of the issues in the CE market overall. If you see, last year investment volume was around 220 billion, and CE was 7.8 billion. Yeah, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I mean there's two ways of. I mean, if you've got big chunks of capital to get out, there's two ways of doing it. Either you buy a platform, like TPG did, or you go indirect. And, you know, you'll see a lot of familiar faces, investors out there now, but their backers are different. So even Europa Capital, I mean, you know, we've traditionally had a lot of endowments in our fund investors, our LPs, but that's changed recently. Now there's a lot more pension funds, and a lot more foreign other investors from the U.S. Mostly it was U.S. before, but now we're getting a lot of Europeans and Asians and Middle Eastern investors. So, I mean, it's changing. You don't see it so much because it's the same. It's still me, but it's different people's money.
That's a very interesting point. To look at CEE in particular, Hadley, I think, touched on this a little bit earlier. What are the particulars of the CEE market that makes it, as opposed to elsewhere in Europe or elsewhere in the world, attractive for investors right now?
Growth.
Yield
that's
chasing.
Where there's growth.
Yield
look at
chasing
GDP
as well.
Growth. And that's as simple as that. If you look at the case that we're always making is relative value. You look at the cap rates that may be in Western Europe, and you look at the growth prospects for your money. You want to be investing in an economy that's growing because then there's a need for space, and that's going to drive values going forward. So I think no matter where you look, whether it's Poland, even looking down into Romania right now, there's a story, a thesis for investing in growth.
True. But on the other side, also transparency. Yeah. That's so the good thing is, I mean, you have growth on one side, but you have... I mean, you have very experienced partners. I mean, you hear that here from the panel and other people. I mean, they are 15, 20 years in the industry. And, I mean, you really have standards. Yeah, you have the legal framework. You have a lot of banks being active. It's a very liquid market. But on the other side, also, you have still growth. And you had it also during the crisis.
And there is a premium for it. Yeah. So don't forget that the yield chasing also is one of the factors.
I think it's become, you know, if you go back 15 years ago, sort of Poland was the new horizon. Now Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia are seen almost as core as Germany. And they're not quite there, but they're much more acceptable. And probably the new countries are the Romania. And even there, the governments with American influence have been really cleaning up their act. So, the opportunity for investors and the returns you want is moving things slightly east. And that's also linked to the fact that a lot of manufacturing has moved east. So a lot of what was German manufacturing took place in Poland. That's now moving to Romania, where the cost of labour is so much lower and flexibility is so much higher.
And I mean, all transactions are, they are euro-linked. Yeah. So even if you have local currencies, and I mean, there were a lot of discussions about currencies in the past, but still, I mean, purchase prices there in euro, rents are denominated in euro, loans are in euro. So you are also from that perspective, I mean, you have a quite stable environment if you stay in the euro. Yeah, and also on the other side, I mean, that's what Robert said. I mean, you have very low interest rates, so that's why still leverage-wise, I mean, still you are in ranges where you say it's 65-70%, and still you can achieve your returns. Yeah, because if you say overall interest rates are at a level of around about 2%, yields are, let's say, 6%, still you have this 4%. Spread where you say, okay, that still gives you with 65% leverage a decent return of, I don't know, 12, 13, 40%, where, for example, in 2006 or 2007, you had an interest rate of 4 plus margin, let's say 5, 6%. So sometimes you even had negative income then in certain jurisdictions. But this is right now, that completely changed. That's why, for example, in 2006, 2007, leverage requirements were at a level of, I don't know, to achieve these returns of 80-85%, and then you went into the crisis, and of course all of a sudden you have seen LTVs of, I don't know, 110-120%, and of course then you had a lot of defaults, and this is right now a complete different situation right now.
If you look back to 2007, then the insurance sector were net sellers of real estate. And if you look what they're doing now, they're quite big net buyers. Mm. So there's a big difference.
Is in Central and Eastern Europe, the kind of two possible things from an international investor perspective which could be seen as negatives, and be interesting to see what the panel think. The first is liquidity, and the second is scale, which was already touched on a little bit, combined with lots of different countries, different legal systems, different regimes, different economies, et cetera, that makes it hard for investors to achieve simple scale, which is something that a lot of these people wishing to place huge amounts of capital very quickly are really looking for. Are these still proving to be disadvantages in Central and Eastern Europe?
I think that the consequence of what you said in terms of the size is that this is something what we have experienced in our practice last year, especially, that the number of cross-border portfolio transactions, and this is the flavor of 2014, this will be flavor of 2015, and God willing, 2016, but that's how the issue is addressed of the volume, because that was actually the biggest problem, that people wanted to push more money than it was actually possible to do on individual transaction. But if you do cross-border portfolio deals, that it becomes possible. And, you know, the legal differentiations between the Polish, Czech or Slovak system, for example, are not that actually large.
No, that's true. That's true. And also, I mean, also from a banking perspective, I mean, that becomes very interesting, because there are not that many banks out there who really would provide loans in all these jurisdictions. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, are there certain types of assets or property sectors which are particularly amenable to cross-border portfolios? Ian, I'm thinking about industrial.
Ours is definitely cross-border, there are challenges when you're dealing in cross-border. But, for instance, TPG, when they bought us, they actually did all their due diligence in 6 weeks, bought us in a six-week period. And that was working across 8 countries. So it was possible to do. It's just you've got to organise it properly.
What is it about industrial, do you think, that makes it work cross-border in that way?
I don't think it's particularly warehouses. Maybe it's because we've got very simple buildings. we're simple people. I think it can work in most sectors if you've got the right structure and the right team, and you've done the pre-work before you sell. But I think one of the great things with Central Europe and for us is to be a provider of space to the occupiers, because at the end of the day, it's the person paying the rent that creates the value that everyone is chasing.
So having cross-border occupiers is helpful?
Oh, for someone like us, it's very important to be able to offer a DHL or someone similar space. We can go from Spain right the way through to Sofia in Bulgaria.
Mm. Hadley, do you have a perspective on this?
Industrial, always.
on which sectors are particularly attractive for cross-border portfolios?
Well, I think industrial has led the charge, let's say, last year. And there's no real surprise. I think, there's obviously the weight of money behind a lot of the developers have really focused to where the opportunity and growth is, and that's very much in Eastern Europe and also Russia. Not that much international money went into Russia, but my goodness, the occupational market there boomed last year. So, but what I think is leading it is that there's a growing sense that the, you know, the capital markets are seeing logistics not as the poor cousin anymore. It's so linked now to e-retailing, and the speed of delivery and supply chain is so important in for retail, and the logistics are behind it, that we're seeing that yield compression come very, very close now to the office yields, which puts a huge smile on Ian's face.
And is Central and Eastern Europe particularly attractive for logistics property, do we think?
It's anywhere there's a population, you need logistics. And as manufacturing in somewhere like Romania is picking up, and in Czech Republic, and then things are being shipped back to Germany, you need a supply chain that will get the goods from there across to manufacture. And then e-commerce is getting a lot of the goods from the warehouses actually to your front door or your office.
Yeah, you have very well-employed people in CE, for example, and there are a lot of logistic hubs, for example, that's what you said, Ian, near the German border, yeah, just 20, 30 kilometers away. And so you have, for example, I mean right now, Amazon, for example, or Primark is doing something there, and they are serving, or H&M, yeah, and they're all serving, I mean, Germany or even Europe, out of Poland, Czech Republic, yeah.
But just on one point, sorry, I just... The e-retailing for a warehouse, if you have 100 shirts you're selling in a traditional shop, and you have 100 shirts and you're selling on e-retail, what percentage in terms of space does the e-retailer need versus traditional? I won't go into it, but it's 3 times more warehouse space the e-retailers need. So again, it's the funds, they've done a huge amount of research, really led out of the US on this, and this is one of the reasons why it's been so attractive.
I was going to say that one of the drivers, let's say, if you look at specific Poland, is infrastructure improvements. The creation of these roads is what's creating the opportunity for some logistics and the infrastructure investments that's helping to drive the GDP growth further. So that's what we see more in the CE is infrastructure investments versus what you're seeing in Western Europe.
And that's a challenge in somewhere like Romania, where they're well behind on their infrastructure. And if the country wanted to improve, they should be investing more into their motorways. They've got very, very few motorways, and it's one hell of a dangerous place to drive.
That's a very interesting point. What other sectors are doing well in CEE at the moment? I've heard Polish regional offices, for example, are really looking pretty good. Hadley, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to the BPO. This is all being led by the BPO market, and that is... It's such a powerful employer across Poland and also in Romania. A lot of these BPO markets or companies are moving into Romania in a big way. And what's strange is typically they don't go into the capital city because they don't want to compete with the employment with the KPMGs and the Deloittes. So they've gone into the regional cities. But in Romania, we're seeing they're going into Bucharest in a big way. So that's a very hot market, the office sector there.
But I think the regional office market in Poland has become the new big thing. If you go and do a tour like I do and go and speak to all the agents in Warsaw and ask them what we should be buying this year, they all tell me regional offices. And that's probably a consequence of the fact that Warsaw office market is oversupplied.
I was going to mention that.
Yeah, so there's that. The retail market is probably oversupplied in every single big city in Poland. Logistics is all tied up by these guys, so it makes it difficult. So it's regional offices, but that's a whole new risk profile. But in the 17 years that I've been doing this business, no one was ever going to go and do regional offices apart from 2 or 3 investors. But now it's the big thing, and big boys are getting in there now.
Definitely, regional offices will lead the charge this year, and I think we will be. We've already done last year a deal below 7. I think we will be. Very low 7, in certain cases below 7 in terms of the yields in regional offices.
But of course the question is lot sizes, yeah? Because if we're talking about the wall of capital and talking about 50, 100 million investment target or even higher, I mean, then the question is, okay, whether really, I mean, regional office are of that size, yeah? Because, I mean, talking about the deals we have seen last year, right now, there are some portfolios for sale. There was a portfolio last year transacted. I mean, then probably there is a certain lot size, for example, Starwood, when they acquired the Galamco portfolio. But overall, it is an interesting market, But I would not overestimate. I mean, how big it is really overall. Yeah, but definitely. I mean, for example, Krakow or Wrocław. I mean, these are interesting places for investments at the moment.
So what's going on with the Warsaw office market then? How are people feeling about that? Optimistic, pessimistic?
It's challenged. Let's put it that way. Challenged.
Can you elaborate on that?
No, I mean, if there's market rents are obviously going down, the vacancy rate's going up. There's a lot of product that's coming to the market, so it's a good opportunity if you're a tenant. If you look at the gap between the headline and the effective, whereas in the past it was maybe 10% or something like that, we see it heading up to even 30%. And it's the occupation, the occupational market that's going to benefit from this. And in Warsaw, what we're anticipating is that this supply will finally begin to taper off, let's say, in 2017. So if you can stay alive and stay relevant until that time, then it should, you know, be in a good position going forward. But it's definitely a challenging market.
So it's a classic old story of too many people building too many buildings ahead of economic growth?
It's the typical cycle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have seen this in the past. I mean, Hedley just mentioned, okay, he has seen three cycles or how many?
Three cycles. This is the third one.
So, I mean, that's the typical cycle. I think the main problem is really here the term of the fund, the lifetime of the of funds overall, because I think that's one of the main issues here, because typical target term is around about 5 to 7 years. And what they do is, I mean, they bought an asset 5, 6, 7 years ago for a yield of 6%. They haven't invested during lifetime, and right now they have to sell. And of course, I mean, that is really an issue. I mean, if you're really forced to do that, so I think that would be also one of the important things, that really you have much more flexible. I mean, if you're investing and really thinking about a target of I don't know, 10 years, for example. So thinking about new investors like insurance companies, I mean, that's definitely something which is important, that you have enough time really and sufficient equity also to invest and to defend your position when it comes to to lease terminations and so on. Yeah, we have seen this, for example, in Mokotów.
Yeah, what I just would add to that in terms of what the pool of investors, this institutional capital coming into Central Europe, previously a lot of funds were set up, so as you're mentioning, commingled funds with a finite life, so it did create situations where fund managers were being forced to sell assets at maybe not the right time in the property cycle. So when talking to investors right now, if they're like-minded and they'll go into a club or a JV of some kind, they're talking also about the concept of evergreen. Like, if you have a great shopping center, like one of the things we're working on right now is the recapitalization of our outlet centers. And these are well-performing assets that once they're up and going, they have momentum. So why put them into a fund where you have to make a decision to sell at a certain time? The investors want to have the possibility of evergreen. Like, you know, we're under no pressure to sell within a certain time frame.
Yeah, I would say don't make the mistake that with all this new wall of capital coming into the market that there are no cycles anymore. There will be cycles. They have been, and going forward there will be cycles. The luxury that some of these new capital have is they can look beyond the cycle, and they actually are interested to ride out the cycle, because in the end they're looking at the income, which hopefully is inflation protected, which for them is the important. That's why they're looking at these evergreen situations, which is different than the last wave of capital we saw, which was much more focused on quick turnaround of capital gains. And I think that is a big difference.
That's true. And it all comes to diversification. Yeah, I mean, talking about regional office, for example, in Poland, talking about other countries, yeah, for example, looking at Hungary, looking at Budapest. I mean, I think that's why a lot of Asian or American investors also they think about Europe, because I mean it's so diversified. Yeah, looking at the UK, looking at Germany, looking at France, looking at CE, and really you can have a very diversified portfolio.
Interesting point. We talk about the Warsaw office market being beset by the classic cycle, supply demand imbalance. Are there any other property sectors in CEE at the moment where that kind of slight oversupply situation may be beginning to emerge? Anyone got any concerns about it?
Well, as I said, I think the retail shopping centre market in the regional cities is oversupplied. I mean, you know, the already every discussion you have, we sold the shopping centre last year, so we know, and Every discussion you have with tenants, they don't want to put the rent up, I can tell you. You know, it's all about reducing
rent. What tenant
rent.
Ever wants to put the rent up?
Well, exactly. But, you know, they always want a reduction and, you know, trading's not going so well. And it's really tough. And there's too many shopping centres. And I think Poland has a problem with urban planning because it needs to control...
It doesn't have one.
Yeah, well, okay, it doesn't have one, exactly. So it needs to control its... you know, what a regional city doesn't want is a load of dead shopping centres. You don't want that. So you can't, I mean, they just keep allowing people to build these things. And, you know, I think that's a big risk for the region.
But also an advantage, right?
It also creates the opportunity, right? The first generation shopping centres, you can look at alternative uses because usually good location, so it'll be conversion to residential or another play on the outlet space or doing some kind of combine. So these first generation centers are the hypermarket type of centers. It does also create an opportunity. So.
No, exactly. Revitalization, yeah. I mean, that you're really targeting, I mean, existing schemes. I mean, that's also what a lot of investors are doing at the moment. And then really to put some fresh equity in and make them even stronger, yeah.
We haven't mentioned the R word yet, although Hadley mentioned Russia briefly. Is what's going on in Russia having any kind of impact on either sentiment, investment decision-making, et cetera, in CEE? Is anyone seeing any impact of that, being asked about it at all?
The only impact that we've seen, we have an outlet center in Gdansk where there was a lot of Russian trade, and that's obviously gone off a little bit. So that's the only impact that we've seen. But I get phone calls from people like, are the Russians invading? Is that a big risk? You know, basically, you know, Poland and the CEE countries are NATO countries. I think there's a very, very low probability of what's happening in the Ukraine spilling over into Russia, into Poland.
We actually had an investor ask us if we were concerned. Our headquarters is in Prague. Were we concerned that Russia might invade? And I had to point out that their investments, if they've already come through Germany, Hungary, and Romania, we've got bigger problems in the world.
Yeah, but if you look at Hungary, for example, I mean, you know, Mr. Orbán is. Had discussions with Putin, there's all that sort of going on. So people are nervous about it. Yeah. And, you know, political risk can be kind of binary sometimes. So, you know, it's not a question of return, it's a question of whether you're going to do it or not. And, I think that whilst it doesn't seem to have had an impact on people investing in the region, I do think people are concerned about it. They're not going to tell you that they want a higher return because of it. They're just not going to invest and you won't hear from them.
We do see from the warehouse side, there are some people who were previously shipping goods into Russia, and that's now stopped. So some car manufacturers are concerned what they're doing, but their other markets have picked up. So it's certainly not a major problem at the moment, but there is an influence, and there is nervousness from investors. You know, if you've got Romania with a big border, and they say Hungary, then yes, any investor these days looks almost... We've come out of the area where they were looking for a cross... Anything that had one cross on a page of questions, they wouldn't invest. Now at least they look at the risk and decide what it is, but yeah, they have to look at it.
But of course it's good, for example, for Poland, Czech Republic, because everyone right now, talking about CE, I mean, a couple of years ago we talked about, I don't know, eight countries, yeah, including Slovenia, Croatia and all the others. So invested in equity was really spreading around all these countries right now. I mean, really these two countries, a lot of money is right now chasing these two countries, because, I mean, they moved back from Russia and all others.
I can say that last year we have worked for three investors who have never been to Poland. They invested in Ukraine and Russia. And after what happened, they are out of those two countries. And they came to Poland. I know that they are now active and looking at Czech Republic and generally CEE region.
So what we could call a flight to safety within CEE. This brings us to Hadley. Did you want to make a...
I mean, I think, you know, don't forget, you know, there's Russian money coming out of Russia. I mean, O1 bought 100 properties across the region in Germany. So, you know, there's geopolitical risk, clearly, and it's not just Russia. And I think this wall of capital, there is a risk. And I think, again, in Europe, we're seeing a lot of the big players who've been around a long time remember... that it wasn't so easy in 2009 to sell them in the regional cities in Germany. Mm. You know, buildings in Birmingham are now trading under 5%.
In and Bristol, 4.9.
4.9. And suddenly Warsaw, and suddenly Berlin, London, Paris is becoming perhaps a little bit more attractive.
Mm-hmm. The flip side of this flight to safety narrative is to places it leaves behind. So we haven't yet touched on the Baltics and southern Eastern Europe. What's going on in those markets at the moment?
These are small markets. I mean, and of course, we looked at this, I mean, before the crisis.
Try mine. Mine always works.
No, but we never achieved a certain lot size in these markets. Yeah, but I think talking about markets to expand to, I would say Hungary, for example, that could be an interesting market. And we have done a deal last year there. We are looking at one right now. So on an opportunistic basis, that makes sense. Romania, for example, because look at population, for example. Yeah, so Romania has a certain lot size with, I don't know, 20 million inhabitants. 20 million inhabitants right now, so Poland 40. So that is something which makes it interesting, because I mean you have to be careful. I mean saying okay, well let's do investment in CEE and spread it across 8 countries. Yeah, so you have to know what you're doing. I mean, you know what's the name of the capital city in these countries, yeah? So that's the first step, and also, I mean, you have to feel comfortable within, for example, with Poland, Czech Republic, and then probably one or two other countries. And I think there you can see these investors; they are very successful. They know the market and they know what they are doing.
Okay, a little bit now optimistic information. Hungary now. Okay, Hungary enough, last year, 580 million, which is the largest for a long, long, long time.
You got prepared.
Yeah, for a change, and actually new players. Some of the acquisitions were done by the domestic players, which was Hungarian National Bank and Hungarian Diófa Real Estate Investment Management. They actually generated 20% of sales. I've done 2 transactions last year in Hungary. This year we'll have at least 3 more, but you know, it looks like Hungary is you know, coming back. In terms of Romania, of course, the numbers, you know, they are what they are, but if you look at the growth, last year, 3 times more than in 2013. So Romania is definitely back on the map, and of course, you have to be careful. The problem with transparency of the legal system in Romania still does exist, especially in real estate. But as you said, the experienced investors will be back looking at the higher yields and opportunities over there.
Yeah, and I think we talk about countries all the time, but many of the international investors, they rather look at cities and conglomerations rather than countries. And being the fact that you're in a country is almost like the second thing they look at. And there's a big difference between, for instance, Barcelona and Madrid and the rest of Spain.
Good point. Now, I think final question for you guys, and then maybe we have time to just do a couple of quick questions from the floor before we round it up. The wall of money sounds like a very permanent kind of thing. It sounds very nice. You know, this is great. There's all this cash floating around. Is this going to last? Is this a blip? What's the prospects for the CEE real estate market? Anyone want to take a punt?
It's working.
It's working.
Now, if so what we saw with quantitative easing in the States was a wave of money coming across the ocean, and it kind of hit the major cities in Europe of 2013. But the same wave is not flooding south from Poland. I think we're going to see, as we've discussed, Romania will be the story this year. I think we're going to see a lot of activity in Romania. There's a lot of growth. There's some really good quality product coming to the market. As the wave comes south from Poland, the question is how far further south is it going to go? It's definitely not going to go east.
Exactly.
But of course, I mean, what is very important is the low interest rate environment, I would say. Yeah, because I mean that makes it very, very exciting at the moment. Even if that's what I said at the beginning, yields around 6%. Yeah, the yield play there. So if we face, and that the good thing is that the outlook is that at the moment that will continue. And if that continues, and also the question, and there are no that many alternative investments, I think then there is still the wall of capital existent, and it's really pushing, and it's also looking at CEE for sure. Because, I mean, we have seen, for example, huge increase in investment figures, for example, in Spain, but also yields came down there. So at the moment, I mean, that's also what we said at the beginning. I mean, CE is very close to Germany, other stable markets, but it has the growth potential, it has the transparency, and that's why it is so interesting to invest, especially if you can do a larger cross-border deal.
Yeah, and I think that rental growth has still got a thing to play. I mean, there hasn't been any rental growth in Central Europe for a while, apart from maybe in the logistics sector, but that seems to go up and down. So I think that's a big opportunity, because whilst yields have come in, there's been no rental growth.
Quite.
So it's actually gone down probably over the last 5 years. So I think that's an opportunity that people can hope on. Mm. That's certainly what we're looking at, is trying to buy in towns or cities where there is a chance for rental growth. Warsaw's not the best one, but the other big cities are. I mean, you know, Budapest is a good one. There's been no supply built in Budapest for 5 years. So if you can overcome your political concerns, and you know, that's quite an interesting market, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think for us in the shed market, no one's been building speculative. We've heard about other markets where there's been an oversupply of offices. Everyone's trying to sort of build ahead. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened in warehouse market. And so somewhere like Slovakia, there's just under 5% vacancy, which represents about 2.5 months of vacancy in warehouses. So we're tending to do speculative attached to build-to-suits. Mm. So in our market, that's when there's a shortage, then you can start to see rents grow. Mm. That's not happening everywhere, and certainly Poland is more challenging than most on rental growth. Mm. But in other places, we are seeing it already.
Yeah. Okay. Actually,
two questions. Firstly, real estate versus the other asset classes. Mm. So when is real estate less attractive? And also, what will happen when they've reached that 10% threshold that they have allocation that they want? Is CPBRB going from 14 to 20? Probably not. So then you lose some of the power which is behind that wave. Mm. The next question is, if real estate is still attractive, when will CE stop being attractive? And that's all about relativity of CE, where there's growth and higher yields available, mm, versus some markets where that's not the case. Mm. So if that changes, then it will stop.
One word of caution, though. I was speaking to someone who's probably been through 5 cycles, and he's a very, very, very successful long-term player. And I was with him about a week ago, and he said he was talking about an asset that he was the second bidder on. And the person who actually bid the asset was in the UK, called him up. I don't know whether it was to gloat or to say sorry. And he honestly said, you know what, at the price you paid, you can have it. So there's risk out there. And, you know, as long as, you know, asset management, quality people, and keeping the young 30-year-olds away from the spreadsheets is very, very, very important right now in all markets across Europe.
I would second that statement. In terms of core, there was a few years ago, the investors were talking about core, you know, unlevered, and you look at the pricing level, this whole flight to core made these priced to perfection, so that the investors are now saying what they thought was really a core asset is going to have some challenges, and that's why they're looking to go further up the risk curve to value add or opportunistic, where you are going to get paid for those risks instead of this overpricing, this flight to core that has made unsustainable returns.
I think it's an opportunity. I mean, I think no one, and I'm surprised the EBRD really think that something like Romania is going to catch up with Germany, because both have growth and they're growing at their own rates. But equally, the fact that labour is a lower cost in Romania is an opportunity. And so in real estate, having the disparity between them is the opportunity that we can all use. And I think that if I look at education in somewhere like Romania, where the English is spoken probably 10, 20 times better than the Czech Republic, you can go anywhere in Romania and they speak English, because their TV is in English with subtitles in Romanian. So I think some strange comments. I haven't read the report, but I think there will always be a difference. I would never see them catching up. I would expect London and others to go away. But then you can either invest in London and be buying warehouses. The latest warehouse on the market is 4.5% in London, or you can be looking in Bucharest at 9%, and you've probably got the same company, same covenant for the same length of time. Not the same length of time. London's 25 years, but for a good long period. So you choose where the opportunity is and where the growth is, because there'll be less growth in London than probably Romania.
But I would say there may be some merit to what the EBRD is saying. So if you look at Western Germany versus Eastern Germany, a lot of money went in there. Still has not, let's say, converged, but there's still opportunities there. And so Poland is not on the same level of comparison, let's say, with Bulgaria. So there's going to be gaps. But do you invest where you see growth, where you see opportunities? And I think there's enough of a market, investment market in Central Eastern Europe, that even though this may not be complete convergence, there's still going to continue to be growth in those markets.
And I mean, just from our personal views, I mean, we are right now 20 years active in CE. And if you see, if you go to these countries and if you see how they changed and how they improved, I mean, for example, go to Warsaw. 10 years ago, there was a big Russian market at the stadium on the other side of the river. Yeah, I mean, and this is all gone. Yeah, you had the European Championship there. I mean, it's getting a safe place right now. These are soft factors, but if you see how the cities changed and also the other, I mean, if you drive right now the new motorway, for example, from Warsaw to Berlin. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't do this, I mean, 5 years ago right now. But they're building the new tube right now in Warsaw, for example. Yeah, and you see the improvement. And of course, I mean, from a pure comparison point of view, of course, you can say, well, they are never getting there. But if you see what was the improvement, I mean, it's fantastic. Yeah, if you go to these cities.
Can I try and excuse myself rather badly? And I have one final point, but I would say agents and bankers are pretty similar. They often produce research that justifies their own jobs.
Thank you.
Okay, just one small one, because there was reference to the historic reasons. I would say this. Before the Second World War, Poland was at par with Spain, and I don't see a reason why it wouldn't be again at par with Spain, at par, you know, within, okay, next 10 years. I don't think Poland will be at par with Germany, at least not during my generation or my kids' generation, but I can easily imagine that we will be at par with economies like Spain or Italy within next 10, 15 years, so during my lifetime, I hope.
But if it comes, for example, to shopping centers, my wife is always saying, okay, well, it was much better shopping in Warsaw than in Munich, for example. Yeah. So in terms of shopping centers and what is the offer there, and of course you're saying it's over-retailed, all these cities, but I mean, for women, I mean, it's a great place. I mean, they can shop there. They can even, if there's a kids' play, it's open on Sunday. In Munich, it's closed, for example. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a dream world in terms of shopping.
This is the
it is. That's why you're at the far end from me, I can see. I think we have a question down here. Is there a gentleman down here?
No?
I think this gentleman here at the front. There. That.
Sorry. Okay. Alex Zentile Miller, Chapman Taylor, Warsaw, Poland, British company in Poland. We've been there for about 15 years, and I'm an architect, so the question is going to be not exactly perhaps related to what the panel was about, but I hope it will relate to it. We're talking about the wall of capital, and we're talking about investing that money in Central and Eastern Europe. And we also have been talking about oversupply and undersupply of certain types of buildings. But nobody has mentioned quality of that building fabric. And if money is going to be invested, and invested well, presumably long term, then the question of quality of the building fabric comes into that discussion. And therefore, my question would be, oversupply or undersupply of a good quality buildings for a long term healthy investment? I'd like the panel to comment on that. Thank you.
Quality. Anyone want to talk about quality?
Mine's easy because on warehouses, we're simple sheds. Boxes, 50 sheds of grey, gets exciting. And for us, quality is everything. That's what differentiates people. And people think that a warehouse is a warehouse, it's a grey box. Actually, it's quite a sophisticated structure around someone's process. And certainly we believe quality and making buildings green is something even in warehousing we have to do. Unfortunately, valuers at the moment don't value differently between a green warehouse that's eco-friendly and that's not.
Mm. At the moment, for example, we want to issue green bonds, and so we were checking the whole portfolio across Europe where we could find good quality, sustainable buildings, And it was very easy to select five assets in Poland, for example. And right now we have a presentation doing this across Europe where we have then a couple of buildings from Poland, which clearly shows that there are a lot of sustainable, good quality buildings.
But also in terms of the quality aspect of it, one of the areas that we like looking at for investment is on the residential side. There's definitely an undersupply of good quality residential space in a lot of these CE markets. And so that could be an opportunity to create that quality living space for people going forward.
I just want to thank very much Kate Allen for chairing today's panel debate, and to all of our panelists for joining us. We hope very much we will see you for the next episode of Seeker on 14th of April for the Seeker Gala. We have, as the publicity should now be showing, at the Seeker Gala this year, we have Hot Chocolate, continuing our theme of 70s, 80s funk bands. And it should be a lot of fun, and we will there be announcing the winners of this year's Seeker Awards. Earlier today, we announced the winners of the four Real Green Awards, and then that'll be the show over for this year. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you enjoy it. I wish you all a successful MIPIM. Thanks very much again to everybody, and look forward to seeing you in a month's time. Such a thing, you sex a thing.